Joyce's Dubliners, though Joyce denied he had read Chekhov. Chekhovian stories start off suddenly, end elliptically, and do not bother to fill in the gaps that we would expect to find closed up in the stories, particularly the longer ones, of Henry James. Still, Chekhov expects you to believe in his realism, his faithfulness to our ordinary existence. Kafka and Borges after him invest themselves in phantasmagoria. Kafka and Borges do not give you dirges for the unlived life. It is not always easy to distinguish the Chekhovian Hemingway-esque mode from the Kafkan Borgesian, because neither style of narration is necessarily interested in telling you a story, as Tolstoy so thoroughly and completely tells you of the life and death of Haji Murad, the Chechen hero, in the short novel named after him. Chekhov and Kafka create from an abyss or void. Tolstoy's superb sense of reality persuades you as only Shakespeare and Cervantes can. But short stories, whether of the Chekhovian or Borgesian kind, constitute an essential form, as Borges remarked. The best of them demand and reward many rereadings. Henry James observed that short stories are placed at that exquisite point where poetry ends and reality begins. That puts them between poems and novels, and their characters, as James again said, must be so strangely, fascinatingly particular, and yet so recognizably general. Plays traditionally imitate actions. Short stories frequently do not. Eudora Welty, probably our best living American storyteller, remarked that D.H. Lawrence's characters don't really speak their words, not conversationally, not to one another. They are not speaking on the street, but are playing like fountains, or radiating like the moon, or storming like the sea, or their silence is the silence of wicked rocks. Lawrence is a visionary extremist, but Welty's eloquent point is well taken for all great stories, which must find their own form, whether Chekhovian or Kafkan. In major short stories, reality becomes fantastic, and phantasmagoria becomes disconcertingly mundane. That may be why so many readers these days shy away from volumes of stories and purchase novels instead, even when the stories are of much higher quality. Short stories favor the tacit. They compel the reader to be active and to discern explanations that the writer avoids. The reader, as I have said before, must slow down quite deliberately and start listening with the inner ear. Such listening overhears the characters as well as hearing them. Think of them as your characters and wonder at what is implied rather than told about them. Unlike most figures in novels, their foregrounding and postgrounding are largely up to you, utilizing the hints subtly provided by the writer. From Turgenev through Eudora Welty and beyond, short story writers refrain from moral judgments. George Eliot was one of the finest of novelists, and Middlemarch, her masterpiece, abounds in fascinating moral judgments. But the most skilled short story writers are as elliptical in regard to moral judgments as they are in regard to continuities of action or the details of a character's past life. You, as reader, are to decide if moral judgment is relevant, and then the judgment will be yours to make. The reader derives immense benefits from the significant blanks provided both by the Chekhovian and the Borgesian mode. At the same time, one has to be wary of supposed symbolism, which is more often absent than present in a masterful short story. Even the great horror story The Horla of Maupassant does not overtly render the Horla symbolic, though I have suggested above that there may be some relation between Maupassant's syphilitic madness and his nameless protagonist's obsession with the Horla. To a certain degree, symbolism is as foreign to the good short story as literary allusion should be. Nabokov is a superbly outrageous exception to my attempt to formulate a Bloom's Law for short fiction. Nabokov is frequently elusive, though rarely symbolic. Symbolism is dangerous for short stories, since novels can have world enough and time to mask emblems naturalistically. But stories, necessarily more abrupt, have difficulty in rendering them unobtrusive. I conclude this epilogue to the how and why of reading the short story by offering the double judgment that the Chekhovian, Hemingway-esque, and Borgesian modes need never be preferred one to the other. We want them for different needs. If the first gratifies our hunger for reality, the second teaches us how ravenous we still are for what is beyond supposed reality. Clearly, we read the two schools differently, questing for truth with Chekhov, or for the turning inside out of truth with the Kafkan Borgesians. Landolfi's Gogol destroys his rubber doll of a wife, and we are as strongly affected as we are when Chekhov's student stops by the campfire of the two bereft women and tells them the tale of St. Peter. Our energies of response are different in quality, but they are equally intense. Chapter 2. Poems. Introduction. I have not organized this section chronologically, but thematically and by juxtaposition, because poetry tends to be freer from history than our prose fiction or drama. And even as I emphasize poetic argument rather than societal context, so I do not discuss poetic form. On all questions of the schemes, patterns, forms, meters, rhymes of poetry in English, the indispensable authority is John Hollander's Rhymes, Reason, A Guide to English Verse, readily available in paperback. My concern here, as elsewhere in this book, is how to read and why, which in regard to poems, generally and specifically, is for me a quest for the larger created presences of the imagination. Poetry is the crown of imaginative literature, in my judgment, because it is a prophetic mode. I begin with instances of pure lyric by A. E. Housman, William Blake, Walter Savage Landor, and Tennyson's fragment The Eagle. These represent poetry at its most economical and poignant, and lead me into two of the greatest of dramatic monologues, Tennyson's eloquent Ulysses, and Robert Browning's extraordinary Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came. Whitman's Song of Myself is then juxtaposed to these monologues as the major instance of the American replacement of dramatic monologue by the epic of self-reliance, to employ Emerson's term. Emily Dickinson's lyric of self-reliance follows, after which I return to Victorian England for a fierce lyric of the self by Emily Bronte. The mood and spirit of Dickinson and of Bronte is related to the so-called popular ballad or border ballad. I analyze here my two favorite ballads, Sir Patrick Spence and The Unquiet Grave, before turning to the greatest anonymous poem in the language, the astonishing Tom o' Bedlam, a mad song worthy of Shakespeare himself. That leads on to three of Shakespeare's most powerful sonnets. Shakespeare's greatest successors in English poetry, Milton and the Romantics, follow in a natural sequence. I wish I had more space for Paradise Lost, but I have sketched how and why Milton's Satan needs to be read and reread. Two lyrics by Wordsworth, the true inventor of modern poetry, are followed by Coleridge's uncanny The Rime of the Ancient Mariner, and by Shelley and Keats at their most haunting. I have reserved a brief discussion of my four favorite modern poets, W.B. Yeats, D.H. Lawrence, Wallace Stevens, and Hart Crane, for the start of my summary observations, since these four poets inherit between them all of the crucial elements in the poems I discuss here. Houseman, Blake, Lander, and Tennyson. Into my heart an air that kills from yon far country blows. What are those blue-remembered hills? What spires, what farms are those? That is the land of lost content. I see it shining plain, the happy highways where I went and cannot come again. That is the 40th lyric of A.E. Houseman's A Shropshire Lad, 1896. Like many of Houseman's poems, it has been in my head for 60 years. As a boy of 8, I would walk about chanting Houseman's and William Blake's lyrics to myself, and I still do, less frequently, yet with undiminished fervor. How to read a poem can best be introduced by reading Houseman, whose concise and economical mode appeals by its apparent simplicity. This artful simplicity conceals the depth, the reverberation, that helps define great poetry. An air that kills is a superb irony, since whether as aria or as the remembered sensation of a breeze, the song or breath paradoxically slays precisely where it should enhance life. Himself born in Worcestershire, Houseman as a child loved Shropshire because its hills were our western horizon. The poems Blue Remembered Hills, part for whole, represent not just an idealized Shropshire, but a transcendent beyond, a happiness that the frustrated Houseman never achieved. There is a plangent emptying out of the self in the declaration, that is the land of lost content, since the content was only an aspiration. And yet, in a sublime affirmation, the poet insists, I see it shining plain. As a pilgrim might insist, he indeed beholds Jerusalem. Those happy highways belonged only to futurity, which is why Houseman cannot come there again. The accent of belatedness is caught and held perfectly, and what we finally see is the saddest kind of love lyric, one that memorializes only a dream of youth. Houseman's directness helps to suggest a first principle for how to read poems. Closely, because a true criterion for any good poem is that it will sustain a very close reading indeed. Here is William Blake, far grander than Houseman, but giving us a lyric that again seems simple and direct, The Sick Rose. O rose, thou art sick, the invisible worm that flies in the night, in the howling storm, has found out thy bed of crimson joy, and his dark secret love does thy life destroy. Blake's tone, unlike Houseman's, is difficult to describe. Dark secret love has become a permanent phrase for almost any clandestine erotic relation, and whatever destructiveness it entails. The ironies of The Sick Rose are fierce, perhaps cruel in their relentlessness. What Blake depicts is altogether natural, and yet the poem's perspective renders the natural itself into a social ritual in which phallic menace is set against female self-gratification. The rose's bed is one of crimson joy before the worm finds it out. Like Houseman's Shropshire lyric, The Sick Rose is best chanted aloud, which may suggest it is a kind of spell, a prophetic outcry against nature and against human nature. Perhaps only William Blake would have waited so brief a lyric, only 34 words, with so dark a visionary burden, but something in poets likes to manifest its creative exuberance by packing much into little. By visionary, I mean a mode of perception in which objects and persons are seen with an augmented intensity that has spiritual overtones. Poetry, so frequently visionary, tries to domesticate the reader in a world where what she gazes upon has a transcendental aura. The romantic poet Walter Savage Landor, whose frequent literary feuds and incessant lawsuits ironically confirmed his middle name, composed remarkable quatrains that were marvelously self-deceptive, like this one, on his 75th birthday. I strove with none, for none was worth my strife. Nature I loved, and next to nature, art. I warmed both hands before the fire of life. It sinks, and I am ready to depart. If one reaches 75, one will want to go about murmuring this epigram on one's birthday anyway, cheerfully knowing its untruth, for oneself as well as for Savage Landor. Very good short poems are particularly memorable, and with that I have arrived at a first crux in how to read poems. Wherever possible, memorize them. Once a staple of good teaching, memorization was abused into repeating by rote, and so was abandoned wrongly. Silent, intensive rereadings of a shorter poem that truly finds you should be followed by recitations to yourself until you discover that you are in possession of the poem. You might start with Tennyson's beautifully orchestrated The Eagle. He clasps the crag with crooked hands, close to the sun in lonely lands. Ringed with the azure world he stands. The wrinkled sea beneath him crawls. He watches from his mountain walls, and like a thunderbolt he falls. The poem is an exercise, triumphant, in matching sound to sense, yet has a sublime aspect also. The Eagle beckons to our imaginative capacity for identification. Robert Penn Warren, who composed astonishing dramatic lyrics about hawks and eagles, once recited Tennyson's eloquent fragment to me at the end of a lunch, and then said, "I wish I had written that." If you memorize The Eagle, you may come to feel that you have written it, so universal is the poem's proud longing. When I was younger, and rather more a patient teacher than I am now, I once persuaded my Yale class in Victorian poetry to join me in memorizing Tennyson's superb dramatic monologue, Ulysses, a poem that gives itself to memorization, and to the critical insights that possession by memory can yield. Hovering in the margins of Tennyson's passionate meditation are other versions of Ulysses, from Homer's Odyssey through Dante's Inferno, on to Shakespeare's Troilus and Cressida, and even to Milton's transformation of Ulysses into the Satan of the earlier books of Paradise Lost. Elusive and contrapuntal, Tennyson's Ulysses is eloquently memorable and very available for memorization, perhaps because something in many readers is tempted so readily to make an identification with this equivocal hero, a permanently central figure in Western literature. Ambivalence, perfected by Shakespeare, is the arousal in us of powerful feelings, both positive and negative, towards an individual. Tennyson's Ulysses, in what appeared to have been the poet's intentions, represents the need to go onwards with life, despite Tennyson's own extraordinary grief for the early death of his closest friend, Arthur Henry Hallam. Much of Tennyson's finest poetry comprises elegies for Hallam, including In Memoriam and The Mort d'Arthur. Yet a profound ambivalence is evoked by Ulysses, the monologist, who begins with what seems a harsh and unloving portrait of his home, the wife, and the subjects to whom he had returned after so many adventures. It little profits that an idle king, by this still hearth, among these barren crags, matched with an aged wife, I mete and dole unequal laws unto a savage race, that hoard and sleep and feed and know not me. That last reproach appears to be the heart of Ulysses' malaise, transcending his ungallant reference to the faithful Penelope's decline, and his unpersuasive protest at the laws he administers, but scarcely desires to improve. The rude Ithacans know not me, the greatness and glory that alone can define Ulysses in his own view. Yet how superb an expression of memorable discontent these five opening lines constitute! How many aging males, throughout the centuries, have reflected in just this mode, heroic to themselves, though not necessarily to others. But Ulysses, however selfish, is already eloquent, and our negative or muted response is swiftly alerted as he continues. I cannot rest from travel. I will drink life to the lees. All times I have enjoyed greatly, have suffered greatly, both with those that loved me and alone, on shore, and when through scudding drifts the rainy Hyades vexed the dim sea. I am become a name, for always roaming with a hungry heart, much have I seen and known, cities of men and manners, climates, councils, governments, myself not least, but honoured of them all, and drunk delight of battle with my peers far on the ringing plains of windy Troy. I am a part of all that I have met, yet all experience is an arch wherethrough gleams that untravelled world, whose margin fades forever and forever when I move. How dull it is to pause, to make an end, to rust unburnished, not to shine in use, as though to breathe were life. Life piled on life were all too little, and of one to me little remains. But every hour is saved from that eternal silence, something more, a bringer of new things, and vile it were for some three suns to store and hoard myself, and this grey spirit yearning in desire to follow knowledge like a sinking star, beyond the utmost bound of human thought. Heroic identification is proffered to the reader, and is very difficult to resist. The ethos here prophesies the code of Hemingway, to live one's life all the way up, except that bullfighters and big game hunters hardly compete with this hero of heroes. The reader notes that Ulysses speaks of those that loved me, but never of those he loved or loves. Yet how moving it is to read, I am become a name, since mere egoism vanishes when we reflect that the name is Ulysses, with all its power of evocation. Myself not least, but honoured of them all, loses its stigma by merging into I am a part of all that I have met. That monosyllabic line distributes its emphasis so that the double I is partly subdued to the all sought and found by the quester. A Shakespearean vitalism, echoing Hamlet's restless spirit, reverberates in this Ulysses as though to breathe were life. An old man is speaking in rejection of the wisdom of age. The poem is taking us to the verge of a last voyage, not foretold by the uncanny Tiresias in the Odyssey, Book 11, lines 100 to 152, when he prophesies the hero's death in rich old age, your country folk in blessed peace around you, Robert Fitzgerald's version. Tennyson's source, so unlike this dramatic monologue in spirit, is Dante's Inferno, Canto 26, where Ulysses is depicted as a transgressive quester. Dante's Ulysses leaves his long sojourn with the sorceress Circe, not to return to Penelope and Ithaca, but to sail beyond the known limits of the world, to break out of the Mediterranean into the chaos of the Atlantic Ocean. Dante silently is aware of the deep identity between his own voyage in the comedy and Ulysses' final quest, but the Christian poet has compelled himself to place Ulysses at the eighth circle down of hell. Close by is Satan, archetype of Ulysses' sin as a fraudulent counselor. Tennyson's Ulysses makes the mad final voyage of Dante's sinner, but Tennyson's protagonist is not a hero-villain. The Victorian Ulysses discovers the proper Victorian in his son Telemachus, whom he pictures as rather a prig. "This is my son, mine own Telemachus, to whom I leave the sceptre and the isle, well loved of me, discerning to fulfil this labour by slow prudence, to make mild a rugged people, and through soft degrees subdue them to the useful and the good. Most blameless is he, centred in the sphere of common duties, decent not to fail in offices of tenderness, and pay meet adoration to my household gods when I am gone. He works his work, I mine." Well loved there is not convincing, compared to the expressive power of "he works his work, I mine." The reader hears the relief with which Ulysses turns away from his virtuous son to address his aged fellow mariners who will make the suicidal voyage with him. "There lies the port. The vessel puffs her sail. There gloom the dark broad seas. My mariners, souls that have toiled and wrought and thought with me, that ever with a frolic welcome took the thunder and the sunshine, and opposed free hearts, free foreheads. You and I are old. Old age hath yet his honour and his toil. Death closes all, but something ere the end, some work of noble note may yet be done, not unbecoming men that strove with gods. The lights begin to twinkle from the rocks. The long day wanes. The slow moon climbs. The deep moans round with many voices. Come, my friends, 'tis not too late to seek a newer world. Push off, and sitting well in order, smite the sounding furrows. For my purpose holds to sail beyond the sunset and the baths of all the western stars until I die. It may be that the gulfs will wash us down. It may be we shall touch the happy isles and see the great Achilles whom we knew. Though much is taken, much abides. And though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. Death Closes All is more like Hamlet than Dante, or Tennyson, and augments in force as a declaration when juxtaposed with this Ulysses' extraordinary sensitivity to light and sound. The lights begin to twinkle from the rocks, the long day wanes, the slow moon climbs, the deep moans round with many voices. Tennyson ends his poem with another clash of antithetical voices, one that is universally human, though much is taken, much abides, and the other that unmistakably echoes Milton's Satan, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. Satan asks the great question, and courage never to submit or yield, and what is else not to be overcome? Dante and Milton, respectively the major Catholic and Protestant poets, would have spoken of yielding to God, but then Tennyson's Ulysses, after a lifetime of struggle with the sea-god, was not likely to yield to any divinity. The reader, wherever she or he stands in regard either to God or to the possibilities of heroism, is moved by Tennyson's extraordinary eloquence, whatever skepticism towards Ulysses the poem subtly suggests to us. Something of how to read this sublime poem has been indicated, but why should we go on reading it? The pleasures of great poetry are many and varied, and Tennyson's Ulysses is, for me, an endless delight. Only rarely can poetry aid us in communing with others. That is a beautiful idealism, except at certain strange moments, like the instant of falling in love. Solitude is the more frequent mark of our condition. How shall we people that solitude? Poems can help us to speak to ourselves more clearly and more fully, and to overhear that speaking. Shakespeare is the largest master of such overhearing. His women and men are our forerunners, as they are also of Tennyson's Ulysses. We speak to an otherness in ourselves, or to what may be best and oldest in ourselves. We read to find ourselves more fully and more strange than otherwise we could hope to find. Robert Browning. For many years I taught that self-overhearing was the particular originality of the major Shakespearean personalities, without recalling where I first encountered the notion. Writing the previous paragraph suddenly reminds me of Tennyson's contemporary, the philosopher John Stuart Mill, whose essay, What is Poetry? 1833, says of a Mozart aria, "We imagine it overheard." Poetry, Mill implies, is also overheard rather than heard. I turn to a masterpiece by Tennyson's true rival, Robert Browning, now much neglected because of his authentic difficulty. Child Roland to the Dark Tower Came takes its title from a song fragment sung by Edgar in Shakespeare's King Lear, Act III, as Scene IV closes. Child Roland to the Dark Tower came, his word was still, "Fie, foe, and fum, I smell the blood of a British man." That is Edgar in his abject disguise of a wandering, roaring mad Tom. A Tom a Bedlam beggar, sometimes called an Abraham man. Supposedly, Edgar quotes a fragment of an old ballad, but that ballad has not been found. And I suspect that Shakespeare himself wrote these horrid nursery lines. Later in this chapter, I will quote and discuss the greatest mad song in the language, the anonymous Tom o' Bedlam, discovered in a literary scrapbook of 1620, and so magnificent a poem that I wish I could ascribe it to Shakespeare simply upon merit. Whether Edgar's chant was Shakespeare's or not, Browning was inspired by it to the most astonishing of all his dramatic monologues. Stanza 1. My first thought was, he lied in every word, that hoary cripple, with malicious eye askance to watch the working of his lie on mine, and mouth scarce able to afford suppression of the glee that pursed and scored its edge at one more victim gained thereby. Stanza 2. What else should he be set for with his staff? What, save to waylay with his lies, ensnare all travellers who might find him posted there and ask the road? I guessed what skull-like laugh would break, what crutch gin write my epitaph for pastime in the dusty thoroughfare. Stanza 3. If at his counsel I should turn aside into that ominous tract which, all agree, hides the Dark Tower, yet, acquiescingly, I did turn as he pointed, neither pride nor hope rekindling at the end descried, so much as gladness that some end might be. stanza 4. For what with my whole worldwide wandering, what with my search drawn out through years, my hope dwindled into a ghost not fit to cope with that obstreperous joy success would bring. I hardly tried now to rebuke the spring my heart made, finding failure in its scope. Who exactly is this eloquently despairing speaker? A child is a noble youth, not yet a knight, but still a candidate for knighthood, though this Roland wants only to be fit to fail in the tradition of those who have preceded him in his quest for the Dark Tower. We are never told who or what inhabits the Dark Tower, but presumably it is that ogre whose word was, "Fie, foe, and fum, I smell the blood of a British man." A grisly prospect, but no more dismal than the appalling wasteland through which the negatively heroic child makes his way. Stanza 10. So on I went. I think I never saw such starved, ignoble nature. Nothing throve. For flowers, as well expect a cedar grove. But cockle, spurge, according to their law, might propagate their kind, with none to awe, you'd think. A burr had been a treasure trove. Stanza 11. No, penury, inertness, and grimace, in some strange sort, were the land's portion. See or shut your eyes, said nature peevishly. It nothing skills. I cannot help my case. 'Tis the last judgment's fire must cure this place, calcine its clods, and set my prisoners free. Stanza 12. If there pushed any ragged thistle stalk above its mates, the head was chopped, the bents were jealous else. What made those holes and rents in the dock's harsh swarth leaves, bruised as to balk all hope of greenness? 'Tis a brute must walk, pashing their life out, with a brute's intents. Stanza 13. As for the grass, it grew as scant as hair in leprosy. Thin, dry blades pricked the mud, which underneath looked kneaded up with blood. One stiff, blind horse, his every bone a stare, stood stupefied, however he came there, thrust out past service from the devil's stud. Stanza 14. Alive? He might be dead, for aught I know, with that red gaunt and colloped neck astrain, and shut eyes underneath the rusty mane. Seldom went such grotesqueness with such woe. I never saw a brute I hated so. He must be wicked to deserve such pain. Whether we, if we rode by this Roland's side, would see a landscape as deformed and broken as he does, is open to question. That terrifying horse, neither quite alive nor dead, seems incontrovertibly described. But would we cry out, "Thrust out past service from the devil's stud?" Or go on to the childlike reflection, "I never saw a brute I hated so. He must be wicked to deserve such pain." You don't leave a small child alone with a wounded kitten, and one wonders how safe it is to let Child Roland ride alone. Desperate at his own vision, Roland tries to summon up images of his forerunners in the quest for the Dark Tower, but remembers only dear friends disgraced as traitors. "Back, therefore, to my darkening path again," he cries out. Yet we should know that the reader ought to question what the child sees. T.S. Eliot's harsh "The Wasteland" can seem mild compared to this landscape. Stanza 20. So petty, yet so spiteful. All along, low, scrubby alders kneeled down over it. Drenched willows flung them headlong in a fit of mute despair. A suicidal throng. The river which had done them all the wrong, whate'er that was, rolled by, deterred no whit. Stanza 21. Which, while I forded, good saints, how I feared to set my foot upon a dead man's cheek each step, or feel the spear I thrust to seek for hollows, tangled in his hair or beard. It may have been a water rat I speared, but ugh, it sounded like a baby's shriek. Stanza 22. Glad was I when I reached the other bank. Now for a better country. Vain presage! Who were the strugglers? What war did they wage, whose savage trample thus could pad the dank soil to a plash? Toads in a poisoned tank, or wildcats in a red-hot iron cage? Stanza 23. The fight must so have seemed in that fell cirque. What penned them there, with all the plain to choose? No footprint leading to the horrid muse, none out of it. Mad brewage set to work their brains, no doubt, like galley slaves the Turk pits for his pastime, Christians against Jews. Stanza 24. And more than that, a furlong on, why there, what bad use was the engine for that wheel or brake, not wheel, that harrow fit to reel men's bodies out like silk, with all the air of Tophet's tool on earth left unaware, or brought to sharpen its rusty teeth of steel? Stanza 25. Then came a bit of stubbed ground, once a wood, next a marsh, it would seem, and now mere earth, desperate and done with. So a fool finds mirth, makes a thing, and then mars it, till his mood changes and off he goes. Within a rood, bog, clay, and rubble, sand and stark black dearth. Stanza 26. Now blotches rankling, coloured gay and grim, now patches where some leanness of the soils broke into moss or substances like boils. Then came some palsied oak, a cleft in him like a distorted mouth that splits its rim, gaping at death, and dies while it recoils. That which we are, that only we can see. An Emersonian reflection prompts the reader to find in Browning's Roland a quester so ruined that the literary equivalent would be difficult to uncover. Dante, marching through his inferno, avoids effects as horrifyingly equivocal as, but ugh, it sounded like a baby's shriek. The harrow of stanza 24 may be an instrument of torment, but the reader has grown sceptical. It appears to be Roland himself who breaks and deforms everything he sees, and who, in consequence, fails to see the object of his quest until it is too late. Stanza 27. And just as far as ever from the end, nought in the distance but the evening, nought to point my footsteps further. At the thought, a great black bird, Apollyon's bosom friend, sailed past, nor beat his wide wing dragon-penned that brushed my cap, perchance the guide I sought. Stanza 28. For looking up, aware I somehow grew, spite of the dusk, the plain had given place all round to mountains, with such name to grace mere ugly heights and heaps now stolen in view. How thus they had surprised me! Solve it, you! How to get from them was no clearer case. Stanza 29. Yet half I seemed to recognize some trick of mischief happened to me, God knows when, in a bad dream, perhaps. Here ended, then, progress this way, when in the very nick of giving up, one time more, came a click, as when a trap shuts. You're inside the den. That great black bird is by no means likely to be bosom friend to the Apollyon who, in the revelation of St. John the Divine, chapter 9, verse 11, is named the Angel of the Bottomless Pit. I know of only a few other effects in English poetry as sublimely stirring as the concluding stanzas of this poem. Stanza 30. Burningly it came on me all at once. This was the place. Those two hills on the right, crouched like two bulls locked horn in horn in fight, while to the left a tall scalped mountain, dunce, doted, a-dozing at the very nunce, after a life spent training for the sight. Stanza 31. What in the midst lay but the tower itself, the round squat turret, blind as the fool's heart, built of brown stone, without a counterpart in the whole world. The tempest's mocking elf points to the shipman thus, the unseen shelf he strikes on, only when the timbers start. Stanza 32. Not see? Because of night, perhaps? Why, day came back again for that. Before it left, the dying sunset kindled through a cleft. The hills, like giants at a hunting, lay, chin upon hand, to see the game at bay. Now stab and end the creature to the heft. Stanza 33. Not here, when noise was everywhere? It tolled, increasing like a bell, names in my ears of all the lost adventurers, my peers, how such a one was strong, and such was bold, and such was fortunate, yet each of old lost, one moment knelled the woe of years. Stanza 34. There they stood, ranged along the hillsides, met to view the last of me, a living frame for one more picture. In a sheet of flame I saw them, and I knew them all. And yet, dauntless, the slughorn to my lips I set and blew. Child Roland to the dark tower came. From burningly, at the start of stanza 30, through in a sheet of flame, I saw them and I knew them all. You stand with Roland in what William Butler Yeats was to call the condition of fire. After training a lifetime so as to recognize your ultimate place of trial, you fail utterly to see where you are until it is too late. What or who is the ogre whom Roland now confronts? This magnificent poem tells you that there is no ogre, there is only the dark tower. What in the midst lay but the tower itself? And the tower is a kind of Kafkan or Borgesian perplexity. It is windowless, blind as the fool's heart, and is at once utterly commonplace and yet unique. What rings Roland at the tower are not ogres, but the shades of his forerunners, the band of brothers who set out upon the doomed quest. Roland was seeking, perhaps only half unknowingly, not just failure, but a direct confrontation with all the failed questers before him. In the dying sunset, he hears what seems a great bell tolling, but magnificently he rallies his will and courage for what should be his final moment. The slughorn, the 18th-century boy-poet, forger Thomas Chatterton, had mistaken that spelling of slogan to mean a trumpet, is sounded defiantly in the mode of Shelley's Trumpet of a Prophecy in the closing lines of his Ode to the West Wind. Drive my dead thoughts over the universe like withered leaves to quicken a new birth, and by the incantation of this verse scatter as from an unextinguished hearth ashes and sparks my words among mankind. Be through my lips to unawakened earth the trumpet of a prophecy. O wind, if winter comes, can spring be far behind? Browning puts a period, not a colon, after "and blue," which evidently means that the concluding "Child Roland to the Dark Tower came" is not the message of the Slughorn. Since this poem came to Browning in a nightmare, that may mean that the entire poem is cyclic, and that Roland must undergo it again and again. But I don't believe that the common reader takes it that way, and the common reader is right. Browning's greatest dramatic monologue does not resolve itself in cyclic despair, and the quester, though nihilistic and self-ruined, recovers honour in his final confrontation with all those who have failed at the Dark Tower before him. There is no ogre. There are only other selves and the self. Exultation surges in the last four stanzas, and this glory is as much the sympathetic reader's as it is Child Roland's. We have renewed and augmented the self despite its despair and its suicidal courting of failure. The depth of the poem's descent becomes an authentication of its final music of triumph. Walt Whitman. The dramatic monologues of Tennyson and Browning represent one major mode of poetry, introspective and ultimately despairing of everything except the strong self and its powers of endurance and defiance. English poetic tradition, from Shakespeare's Hamlet and Milton's Satan on through Romanticism, shapes both Ulysses and Child Roland to the Dark Tower came. The two great American contemporaries of Tennyson and Browning were Walt Whitman and Emily Dickinson, both originals, with a much more equivocal relationship to English tradition. If, as I maintain, a prime reason why we should read is to strengthen the self, then both Whitman and Dickinson are essential poets. The American religion of self-reliance, crucially invented by Ralph Waldo Emerson, triumphs in Whitman and Dickinson in startlingly different ways. Emerson teaches self-trust. Do not seek yourself outside yourself. Walt Whitman's Song of Myself is a direct consequence of Emerson's directive. More evasively, Emily Dickinson's lyrics carry self-reliance to a higher pitch of consciousness than nearly any other post-Shakespearean poetry. In Shakespeare, as I have noted, the extraordinary consciousnesses excel at self-overhearing. Hamlet, Iago, Cleopatra, Prospero. Dickinson maintains this Shakespearean attribute, but Whitman frequently tries to go beyond it. The shock of overhearing yourself is that you apprehend an unexpected otherness. Whitman, particularly in Song of Myself, and in the Seadrift elegy, As I Ebbed with the Ocean of Life, divides his being into three: myself, the real me, or me myself, and my soul. This psychic cartography is highly original and difficult to assimilate to the Freudian model or to any other map of the mind. Yet it is one of the prime reasons why we should read Whitman, who is a subtle and nuanced poet, very unlike what most of his exegetes, past and present, take him to be. Though he proclaims himself to be the poet of democracy, Whitman at his best and most characteristic is a difficult poet, hermetic and elitist. We need never doubt his love for his projected readers. But his self-portrayal frequently is a persona, a mask through which he sings. There is no single real Walt Whitman. The poet, as opposed to the man, is frequently more autoerotic than homoerotic, and much more the solitary singer than the celebrant of the insulted and injured, though he takes care to be that also. I am not suggesting that Whitman is a sleight-of-hand man, but what he gives, his sense of democratic vistas, he sometimes takes away, his art being a shuttle. Yet there is always a richness. Only he and Dickinson among American poets manifest the florabundance that Wallace Stevens later imitated in them. We know, or think we know, Walt Whitman best as Walt Whitman, one of the roughs, an American. But that is the persona or mask of the bard of Song of Myself. Whitman knew far better, because he is a surprisingly difficult poet, though he says otherwise. His work can look easy, but is delicate and evasive. These come to me days and nights, and go from me again, but they are not the me myself. Apart from the pulling and hauling, stands what I am, stands amused, complacent, compassionating, idle, unitary, looks down, is erect, or bends an arm on an impalpable certain rest, looking with side-curved head, curious what will come next, both in and out of the game, and watching and wondering at it. As graceful as it is solitary, this charming me myself is at peace, yet also is a touch wary of intrusion. Whitman begins Song of Myself with an embrace, more gymnosophical than homoerotic, between his outer self and his soul, which appears to be largely an enigma to him, but can be regarded as character or ethos in contrast to personality or the rough masculine self. Yet the real me, or me myself, can have only a negative relationship to the Whitmanian soul. I believe in you, my soul. The other I am must not abase itself to you, and you must not be abased to the other. I is the myself of Song of Myself, or Whitman's poetic personality. The other I am is the me myself, his true inner personality. Whitman fears mutual abasement between his character and his real self, who seem capable only of a master-slave relationship, sadomasochistic and ultimately destructive to both. The reader can surmise that Walt Whitman, one of the roughs, an American, comes into being in order to prevent such an assured mutual destruction. Whitman knows his poetic persona very well, since, according to Vico, we know only what we ourselves have made. His inner self, or real me, he also knows astonishingly well when we reflect how few among us have such knowledge. What Whitman scarcely knows is what he calls my soul. To believe in is not to know, but to take a leap of faith. The Whitmanian soul, rather like the perpetual soul of America, is an enigma, and the reader never feels that Whitman is comfortable with it, despite the harmonious embrace that opens Song of Myself. We come to feel that the me myself is the best and oldest part of Whitman, going back before the creation, whereas the soul belongs to nature, is the unknown element in nature. We learn explicitly, by reading Whitman, what so many Americans seem to know implicitly, that the American soul does not feel free unless it is alone, or alone with Jesus, as our evangelicals put it. Whitman, who was his own Christ, nevertheless shared that impulse of the American soul and converts it into what may be the greatest of his many varied powers, a strength that defies nature, in unison with his soul, as mutually they find their own strength. Dazzling and tremendous, how quick the sunrise would kill me, if I could not now and always send sunrise out of me. We also ascend dazzling and tremendous as the sun. We found our own, O my soul, in the calm and cool of the daybreak. The movement from I, the persona Walt Whitman, to we, self and soul together, is the triumph of this sublime sunrise. Grandest of all American writers, surpassing even Emily Dickinson and Henry James, Whitman transcends the limitation of finding his own soul unknowable. Mastery is the issue between nature and Whitman, and the resolution